Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 325 of the podcast. It's Friday, 9th of June, 2017, as I record this on the morning after the surprising UK election results. We certainly live in interesting times and more people talking about politics than ever. Of course, not on this show, but change continues to be the only constant. So remember that your voice matters both in voting and also in your writing. So if you're feeling emotionally charged over events, whatever country you're living in, whatever political situation you're living under, take your emotions to the page. And that's certainly what I'll be doing in the coming week. So today I have an interview with Dan Blank, who has a new book out, Be the Gateway, a practical guide to sharing your creative work and engaging an audience. And Dan and I have known each other for years online, and we talk about the changes in self-publishing and in book marketing, discussing whether platform is still important with the rise of paid advertising, how to find your specific audience, comparisonitis, and much more. So that is coming up soon. So in publishing this week, there are rumours of a new KDP reporting dashboard being rolled out. I haven't seen it myself. When they change these things, it's sort of a rollout across the world. But I've seen friends on Twitter reporting a new dashboard look around, especially around historical reporting, which is really interesting. So watch out for that on your Amazon KDP. Also, it was Book Expo in New York last week, which is a trade show geared towards traditional publishing, a bit like London Book Fair or Frankfurt. But this year, they decided not to run any events for indie authors. So the Alliance of Independent Authors ran a online fringe, which was amazing. Lots of really interesting talks at selfpublishingadvice.org. You can still go and look at that. There are really interesting talks ranging from how to sell your poetry, market your poetry, which I thought was really interesting, as well as things like what are the secrets of authors making over $5,000 a month from their books, and lots more. So check that out. The lovely Courtney Kenny from projectmanagerwriter.com wrote a great post with her takeaways from Book Expo, which I am going to comment on, because it's interesting that Book Expo decided not to focus on the sort of author track at all. But of course, we are publishers as well, so the things that were found are interesting for us. So Courtney reports a number of things, but I'll just pick a couple of things that I thought was interesting. First of all, a sort of growing trend of DIY activities done in the home with family, certainly amongst millennials, and sort of the shift towards streaming content at home instead of going to the movies. Board games, playing board games together, home meal kits, crafts, and making physical things. And I think this is this is absolutely true, and finding it in for us, certainly, you know, as we become more digital in so many ways, we also look at the physical for the sort of touch and interesting things that we can feel and hold. And I think authors tapping into that family and home and craft is a really good thing. And of course, this is part of the wider maker movement, of which self-publishing is just one small part. People sort of doing things themselves rather than being told what to do. So I thought that was interesting that that's also being seen as a trend within publishing. There were more libraries than Starbucks in the US, which I thought was an interesting thing to report. You know, it's kind of surprising when I've been to a lot of US cities and I always see a lot of Starbucks, but it's encouraging that there's more libraries, and lending for ebooks and audiobooks has experienced growth in libraries. And I mean, one thought for libraries is that they could become more virtual in the future, which is interesting. And also that the library market is 62% women aged 45 to 54, which I thought was fascinating. And you can get into Overdrive, which distributes to libraries through Kobo and also through Smashwords. There was, again, a discussion of growth in audiobooks, which we talked about last week and is a familiar refrain at this point, with podcast listeners twice as likely to listen to audiobooks. So I guess a lot of you listening also listen to audiobooks. And certainly I started with podcasting a number of years ago and then, you know, moved on to listening to audiobooks a couple of years ago, just when you get used to consuming content through audio. And also for, I don't know how many of you listen to this at 1.5 speed or even 2x speed. That's how I also listen to other podcasts and audiobooks as well. So you can actually get through quite a lot of content through audio while you're doing other things. Also interesting, 71% of audio book listeners listened at home, and made me laugh because as I record this, Jonathan's actually in the other room listening to an audiobook. And it has increasingly replaced that sort of reading, daytime reading, for him more so than me. And interesting, because audiobook listeners are 56% male, according to the survey. So I found that fascinating. I definitely still read more in Kindle format and also a print for nonfiction than I do audio, but I do keep listening to audio. So really interesting. And BookBub, there was a little note. BookBub is considering adding audiobook promotions, which would be amazing because the promotional ecosystem for audio right now is pretty much non-existent. There are very few ways to market audiobooks in a way that really moves the needle. So I think that would be awesome if they did that. So a number of other things on that post, check it out at projectmanagerwriter.com. Thanks to Courtney Kenny for a great roundup. And if you attend industry events with interesting takeaways for my audience that would help other authors, please do let me know. So that's really interesting. Then in a crossover between the publishing industry and my futurist segment, my occasional futurist comments, it's kind of not futurist in a way. It's almost now, you know, we're on the edge of this happening and I've been talking about it for a long time. But Amazon is having another go at a smartphone, but targeting India and the emerging markets. It will have Google Play, which is really interesting, and will not be running, nor yet won't be running Fire OS. It will be running the Google Android OS, and it will retail around $93 at launch. And this is a smartphone, and Good eReader reports this, and basically saying that this phone is targeting emerging markets, the next billion users who do not yet have a smartphone. So a couple of years ago, there was the $5 smartphone released in India, but clearly that functionality was not good enough for maybe the way the internet is going. This is a very cheap compared to what many of us will be paying for our smartphones. But very interesting, because also Internet Trends has just released a new report that says India is the world's next major tech market. The country now has 355 million internet users, which is 27% of the population of 1.3 billion. And that is bigger than America. And prices of smartphones and mobile data are falling. Also, mobile devices account for 80% of internet traffic in India. The global average right now is 50%, and of that in the US is under 40%. So this is huge. I think this is really a very big deal. And I mean, I've talked about this before, but essentially these emerging markets that are getting on the internet now, they don't have laptops, they don't have desktops. Some of them do, obviously, but most people are accessing the internet through their phones. So if you are not, like, if your books aren't available to buy digitally on a smartphone, then, you know, what's going on? And secondly, if your website is not mobile optimized, what are you doing? And remember that India, you know, and again, sort of apologizing for the British Raj in many ways, although many Indians, you know, are positive about the impact of it, many educated Indians with money speak English and read in English and, you know, educated middle class. And so the stereotypes are sort of 20 years ago are completely wrong now for this percentage of Indians anyway. So have a think about that when you consider the global market for your ebooks. I was having lunch with someone yesterday and she's just got into this market. And, you know, we were talking about, I was like, I'm so excited about this because we haven't even started yet. Like people think, oh, I'm late coming into digital or, you know, I'm late, you know, self-publishing or whatever. You're not. The market in the US is certainly mature. And, you know, maybe the UK, Canada, Australia are mature, New Zealand, you know, to a point. But still, the adoption of widespread internet and digital, you know, content has yet to come in some of the biggest countries in the world, many of which have English speaking middle class. So I feel like we are not even toddling yet in terms of this market. Also interesting is that on that report, it said Facebook owns 4 of the 10 most popular apps in India. And also Chinese internet giant Alibaba has a 50% market share of the browser, while Chrome is at 30%. So while you and I probably default to Google as a browser, these Indians on their phones are using Alibaba or Chrome as, you know, which is 80% of the market. That's really interesting to me because the way advertising works, the way integration of content works. And also, I mean, I'm thinking Google Play. I mean, that's fascinating stuff. Now, I did try Google Play a while back, pulled away from it, I've been talking about it for a while, but looking to get back into it once Publish Drive, which is looking towards Asia, has multi-currency pricing. I feel that multi-currency pricing is critical for global sales, so I've been waiting for that. But once they have that, I will be using Publish Drive to get into that market. So really fascinating and kind of futurist, but this, if you know, once Amazon launched this cheaper smartphone, that will be a very interesting potential change. And also, still on India, BookBub now promotes to India. Now that's got to say something about the potential of the market. BookBub promote to US, UK, Canada, India, and Australia. Also, what's interesting, so this coming week, as you're listening to the show, I have an international BookBub. So I applied for a BookBub. I didn't get the US one, but I got the non-US one. And so that's what I'm doing this week. It's actually much easier to get an international BookBub if you say you're okay with not doing the US. So very interesting. And if you're concerned about pricing for India, when I was there a couple of years ago, a fiction paperback in a bookstore was about 150 rupees. So if your ebook price is higher than 150 rupees, it's higher than the paperback, unless it's obviously a massive book. So check your ebook prices and remember international pricing for these other markets. So this last week, I finished the edits on The Next Sweet Romance, which I'm very excited about putting out, and How to Market a Book is going through print formatting. I much prefer to pay a professional for formatting my nonfiction especially, but all my books actually. I like getting print paid for because of all the little extras. Plus, it's so finicky. Now, I know that Vellum for print launched, and I have actually bought it, and I am potentially going to do one myself, maybe for self-publishing success, which a lot of people have asked me to do a print version of. It would be like a pamphlet, but you know, maybe I'll just do that to try it out. But I am ready to put pen to paper on the blank page for the map series next week, it's very weird. I'm going through this phase of understanding that I'm actually a fantasy author. I can't remember if I said this last week, but Lindsay Broker said a while ago, you know, you're a fantasy author, don't you? And I'm like, no, I write thriller and crime and horror and all these other things. And she's like, yeah, but all your books have demons in or something supernatural, so they're kind of fantasy. And I'm like, oh yeah. So this map book actually has another world in it. So it does start in this world, but it rapidly moves into an adjoining world, and that very clearly is fantasy. So it's a very interesting thing. I am very nervous about doing it. It feels very much outside my comfort zone, breaking into another series, but I'm looking forward to it. So I've been clearing the decks. I've been doing a lot of admin stuff and excited about that. Also, End of Days, my last Arcane book, which is definitely fantasy. And it's funny, I don't often look at my reviews on Amazon, but I did have a look on one review and it said something about this being definitely a little, you know, further out than expected than some of my other books. So yeah, I'm definitely getting more fantasy, more fantastical as I write. But End of Days is on special this week at 99 cents or 99p in the UK. And so if you're interested in trying my fiction, you can check that out on all the usual places. So that's cool. Also interesting this week, my friend and creative mentor and friend of the show, been on the show a number of times, Mark McGuinness, has a new podcast called The 21st Century Creative. Very good podcast. Mark is very well connected in the creative space. He's also an award-nominated poet and successful entrepreneur, combining art and business. His idea of fun is translating Chaucer from Old English into modern poetic verse. He is a rare combination, but he also likes money. So I love that. I think that's amazing. So check out The 21st Century Creative. You can find it on your usual podcatcher. I'll link to it in the show notes. You can also find it on lateralaction.com. Mark has a really good talk on creativity and business at the beginning of that first show. Plus, he has an interview with Stephen Pressfield, always worth a listen to, and on story and genre conventions and deeper levels, you know, what characters represent and things like that. So really good to listen to that. And of course, Stephen Pressfield writes fiction and nonfiction, so this will be relevant to you regardless of what you write. So check it out, The 21st Century Creative. And yes, I will be appearing on that show at some point. And also useful this week, if you'd like to join me and Nick Stevenson on our live webinar, Wednesday, 14th of June, 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. If you'd like to automate your author marketing and find your first 10,000 readers, all the details are at thecreativepen.com/Nick17, N-I-C-K-1-7. And yes, if you sign up, you will get the replay. And as ever, Nick and I have a good banter, bit of a laugh. I bring my Pinot Noir along, or maybe my gin and tonic. I've got a very nice bottle of gin at the moment. So yes, we have a good time. Of course, and just to say, it's 8 o'clock in the evening in the UK when we do that webinar. So I'm allowed a drink, even if you're not, if you're in other time zones. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Just a little selection. The Kitchen Counter Author said, binge listening to the older podcasts while processing postal vote security slips. Thank you to Kitchen Counter Author for your service during the election. Of course, during election times, a lot of people volunteer their time to make sure the democratic process works. So I'm personally grateful to you and all the other volunteers for helping our voices be heard, however you vote. This is a very important thing. So thank you for that. And I'm thrilled to be part of the electoral process, at least listening to a podcast. Jennifer emailed, said she loved hearing what Jennifer said. I loved hearing about your new reading chair. I bought myself a wonderful reading chair in an antique shop, only to have it promptly taken over by my cat, Lucy, and sent me a lovely picture. And it does look like a lovely writing chair. Feel Good Crafts, binge listening to the podcast while painting the front of my house. Thanks for keeping me sane. Who else? Oh, Sarah Rosette says, today was a fun day, kayaking, writing and listening to the podcast. A lovely picture of kayaking on the river. Oh, the lovely Piorino. I love the name Piorino. It's got a lovely ring to it. I presume it's Italian. Email to say his first short story was published on Amazon because of the show's help and advice. And he says, I know I need to do more work, but the first step is important and I'm working on my second book. So I just thought that was great because Piorino's right. That first step is so important. And that's what I've seen recently with my mum, with the romance that we're doing together. It took her 2 years to do that first book. And
the second book and the third book that, you know, the second book's already in final edits. The third book is, you know, she's done first draft, working on the next draft, and her writing has got so much better. Her confidence is building. And it's really lovely to kind of revisit that process from a new author perspective, even though it's my mum and she's 70. But I feel the same for Pierino. That first short story, that first book, that first novella, that first short nonfiction, that first blog post, anything that you put into the world for the first time, it will change your life, because you realize, well, you realize a lot of things, but you realize that, hey, the worrying about it is, you know, you've kind of got over that. You've put something in the world. You've created something new. It's not just you anymore. There's other people consuming it. And also you realize that, yeah, there's a lot more work to do, but that this is really fun. So congratulations, Pierino, and to everyone who has taken that first step. And if you haven't, then get on with it. It's almost half a year down in 2017. Kevin Switage said of Nick's podcast interview last week, "This podcast was so informative and helpful, printed off the show notes to go back over it." Yes, and remember, all of the podcasts have show notes on thecreativepen.com/podcasts. Pretty much the last 200 episodes have transcripts now, and we kind of occasionally work back into the older shows. But essentially, you can go and get those show notes if you want to, and all the links are there too. Brittany Fichter says, "Cleaning as we listen," sent a lovely picture of her little girl cleaning. And Brittany was pregnant with her little girl when she first started listening to the show. Now baby number two is on the show. And she says, is on the way, sorry, not on the show. "I must admit to feeling a great need for productivity assistance now." Thanks for listening, Brittany. And finally, Anna Hartman sent a really amusing tweet, "A red stone of fire. Puzzled how someone as nice as you can write such gruesome death." And it made me laugh because actually, I think that the more you put your inner darkness on the page and the more you exorcise, as in, you know, get out of yourself the things that are in your head, the happier your life is. So, you know, and some of the happiest people I know write horror. I'm also still intending to write a book about the shadow in creativity, but it's a pretty deep book, and I'm going to start writing that in December when Saturn is dominant and when the darkness covers the land. As such, it's definitely when I feel that kind of creative energy, I guess. So I am going to look at that in December, but that's why, I guess, you know, I bring my darkness to the page and have a very happy life in the meantime. So today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from them in a minute. The corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Aram Durfee, Anna McNuff, and J.R. Wesley. And thanks to everyone who supports the show. Like the tweets and emails, it really demonstrates you enjoy it and want it to continue. And on Patreon, you can support with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you feel like it, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be recording this week as you get this audio. And also, if you're a Platinum supporter, you'll be getting How to Market a Book 3rd Edition ebook early as well. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Kobo, and then we'll be into the interview.
Hello, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Author Relations at Kobo. A lot of authors often ask me, what are our merchandisers looking for? What kind of books are featured on Kobo, and how can I get my books featured on Kobo? Well, this is information that can actually help not just with Kobo, but with some of the other places that are more interested in doing human-based merchandising. So Kobo, Nook, and iBooks are probably more in line with doing this type of promo. And what they're really looking for is professionalism, looking for a fantastic cover that speaks to your target audience. Clean metadata is critical. Putting the right information in the right fields, like title, subtitle, particularly volume number, if you're writing books in a series, that helps us help get those in front of the right customers. And a decent price point, which means doing global pricing, ending your prices in most English language territories with a .99 price, or in European or in pounds at 0.49 or 0.99. And actually thinking about different pricing in different countries. For example, in India, you have to price bargain basement low to get any attention. In the UK, the publishers are very competitive, so you got to keep your prices low there. But in places like Canada or Australia, New Zealand, the tolerance for a slightly higher price is okay, and you can actually walk your price up just a little bit more without hurting your bottom line sales while still giving your readers a good value. You can find more tips like this at KoboWritingLife.com, where you can also click on and publish directly to Kobo through the Kobo Writing Life portal. But let's get back to your host, Joanna Penn, with the Creative Penn Podcast.
Today, I'm here with Dan Blank. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you? Great to be chatting again.
Yeah, I know. It's been a while. So just a little introduction. Dan Blank is an author, professional speaker, and consultant to the publishing industry. He also teaches authors how to grow their platform and target readers through his blog, books, and courses. His latest book is Be the Gateway, a practical guide to sharing your creative work and engaging an audience, which is very cool. Woohoo! So you were last on the show in October 2013, which I was just like, really? Has it been that long? We've seen each other in New York since then. But what's changed for you in the last sort of 3.5 years? And how does that also reflect changes in the publishing industry?
So it's interesting because I think what's changed for authors and even for me and you and to a certain degree is opportunity. We've all come around to understanding that newsletters and webinars and ads and courses and bonuses and digital products, all these things are now accessible, not just to you and me who kind of work on both sides of it, but to the average writer. And that is mind-blowingly awesome. And the flip side that I've seen since 2013 is that everyone feels an incredible sense of pressure. Mm-hmm. So an author could be doing 40 things to launch their book and killing it with like 80% of it, and they will still go to bed feeling bad about themselves because right before they checked Facebook, they saw an ad. You know, if you're not launching this, if you're not doing this for an author, if you're not using Amazon this way, you're missing the boat. So there's this pervasive sense of overwhelm and of that they're never doing enough. And no matter how masterful they get, they're almost being dangled that kind of carrot in a way of saying, you know, I launched a book with no list and no following and no expertise. And now 4 weeks later, I'm a USA Today, you know, I'm this big best-selling author. And where it's not that that's bad. All of that is great. Is there's so much of it. So a lot of what's changed, I think, is that sense of overwhelm. When we first started out, you and me years ago, there was very few courses. You're on social media. There wasn't that sense of like everyone has a newsletter. Everyone has pop-ups. Everyone's sending 40 emails in the newsletter chain. So that's, I think, a big thing of what's changed, the opportunity and the overwhelm that comes with opportunity.
It's a really good point. And of course, you and I both have books, courses, you know, you have consulting. I don't do that. So we're kind of, you know, we're almost part of the overwhelm. And I it's great that you say this though, because, and it's funny you mentioned pop-up, because I finally put a pop-up on my site this January. So January 2017. And of course, you and I know pop-ups have been around for what, 10 years in other niches. So I think what's happened is that internet marketing seems to have gone mainstream in the author niche, which is what you're saying. So then I've got to ask you, because obviously you're, you know, part of you being on the show is you're launching your book, Be the Gateway. So how have you dealt with that comparisonitis, that, I should be doing all of this? How do you deal with
it? It's such a great question. So I would say internally, I have this hobby of watching other people, watching you and watching Mark and watching so many other people create new things and how you share and how you launch them. I think that one thing that I find, and I'm 7 years into this company, is that real sense of understanding what I want for myself and what I want that to embody and then how I want to work with people. Because it's so tantalizing to see someone do something really well and say, I want to do that too, and then try to copy and follow along. I've been down this road enough to know where I've tried so many different things. And in the end, I'm very clear about how I work with people, about my role in working with people, the kinds of people I like working with, and also the lifestyle I want to lead is a very big part of it. I'll say even we can talk more about this later too, you know, even as I launched this book, there were so many decisions about what I was going to write about, the publishing timeline, and how I'm going to launch it, that really had to fit in with my life. We talked before the call, like recently my wife and I have had our second child. And that quote unquote deadline of the due date of the child literally defined everything about this launch and what I would do. And more importantly, there are dozens of things that if I had more time, I would have done. But I said, you know, I really want to do this in this time frame. And because our son is coming, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to let go of the rest for that period of time. And I think that knowing your boundaries and knowing the experiences you want to create for yourself and others, I think that's the key for how I try to manage that, because I'm not unaware of these really interesting things that other people are doing that I'm not doing.
Mm, it's a great point. And I was thinking about this as well. I've been doing yoga now for about 9 months. And that's really helped me, I think, because I've never managed to stick with meditation on its own. But part of every yoga class is meditation and is relaxation and breathing, which I'm actually useless at breathing. It's really funny. And I feel like it's funny because you say, you know, it's about looking at what you want for your life and that perspective. And I really feel that I'm getting to that point as well of like, okay, that, you know, I just have to focus on what I can do and what I want to do and then say no to the rest. So it's interesting there because you've mentioned lots of things, but advertising is one of those things. So coming back to what's changed, when you and I started, there was almost, I mean, you could do paid advertising, but there wasn't much of it. Now it's everywhere. So how does paid advertising fit into your sort of book launch? And do you now consider it mandatory given the environment?
I don't think anything's mandatory. I think it's an opportunity though. I think that when you talk about Amazon ads and Facebook ads and Twitter ads, I think they're wildly more effective than anything you and I had 8 or 10 years ago at our disposal. And I think that you can experiment with them in fun ways. You can use them in very targeted ways. And I guess for myself, with the book, I'll focus on, you know, I think there's that two ways of thinking about it. There is, you know, sales and launch, and then there's branding. I think that when you really think about, I want to be an author and these are the audiences I want to reach, the people, there's a real value in saying, I'm going to take out X dollars a day or a week and just kind of put these ads out there. And I hope they convert, but I know how sales happen. I was talking about this with a friend this week. I hear about a book through this thing and they think, oh, that's going to convert to a sale. No, I closed the Amazon window, went away. I read something else, reminded me of that. 3 days later, I brought it up and I bought it. So even just thinking about branding, there's a value in that. And I think that these ad products do so much for such a little amount of money. Again, you don't have to do them, but I think it's an opportunity. And the nice thing about them is you can say, I don't know anything about these ads. I'm going to spend $35 just to get myself over the hump of my fear of how to take one out. I'll take out an ad for 7 days and I'll play with it. That's still such an amazing thing to me, is the barrier for entry is so low.
Yeah, which means there's more competition. And it's funny because one of the things in my lifestyle is I'm not really a data person. So a lot of that stuff kind of, it's always the thing that moves off my list as opposed to on my list. But, you know, I am running ads, obviously, like everyone else. But I wanted to ask you about, you know, coming back on that. So you mentioned the brand and the longer term platform. So you and I have connected for years because of the whole platform building thing. And I was reflecting on this the other day. Like we would have said 5 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago, as a nonfiction author, you have to have a platform, by which we mean a website and other ways to reach an audience. But now it seems you can actually sell books without a platform using things like paid ads. How do you think for fiction or nonfiction authors that platform, you know, is it still as important as it used to be?
So, I mean, this is actually what the book touches upon. And the way I try to frame it is the idea of what you want is a clear sense of the people you're trying to reach, the message you have, how it aligns with their worldview, the things they resonate with, and have an awareness of the, I'll just call them channels by which people can hear about that. And that can be influencers, you know, the influencers underscore trademark, you know, like that kind of phrase. It's knowing who those people are, who they respect. It's knowing the phrases they go, yeah. Like you'll see a Facebook post, this is like a meme, like, you know, it's like, librarians shaped my life, you know, librarians are my hero. And you'll see a million likes because it's like, you know, that for anyone in the bookish world, like where a lot of my friends, everyone's going to like that. So you know what they like rally for, you know what they're against. I saw a meme the other day that was something, it was something quasi negative. I don't want to say it, but nothing horrible. And everyone liked it. And I was like, because there's a worldview there. And I think that the platform is really your understanding of, you know, this is what I create and why. Is why I think people really resonate with it. This is what I know about those people and where I can find them, if it's a conference, if it's a partnership, if it's an affiliate thing. And that's what I think the quote-unquote platform is, your ability to really know who those people are and really understand how to connect with them. And again, I refer to it more as a gateway. I mean, that's the phrase in the book. And the way I like to think about it too is not even as you create the work, big gap, miles long, you market the work. The way I like to think about it is that this is all creative. And the idea of platform or the gateway is that it's about your crafting experience for someone. Your work, you hope it has an effect in the world. And thinking about how you share that is not you taking off that beautiful, perfect creativity hat, putting on that horrible salesy marketer hat for a couple of weeks around launch. It's like, no, you can write this book and say, I wrote this book and I'm proud of it. It's on my phone now and I'm satisfied. Or you can say, no, I want to publish it. I want to share it. And when you do that, you have to think about the effect in the world and the experience it creates for people. So that's kind of how I think about platform nowadays.
It is so interesting. And as I talk to you, I'm hearing snippets of things. I've got so many questions I want to ask you off the back of this. But I'm going to go with the one that people still ask me all the time, which is, you mentioned several times knowing who the people who are that you want to reach. So knowing your target market. And people are still struggling with this. You know, and again, like if you're creating ads, you have to say like, what keywords are you targeting? What other authors are you targeting? So this is something that's so key, whether you're building a platform, writing a book, doing ads, whatever. So how do you recommend that people find, like decide who those people are? Because I do find that a lot of people still don't understand genre or category and where they fit.
So I run a little mastermind group and I did a video for them the other day and I talked about really having a literacy of your marketplace. This is like learning a new language. It's learning the phrases that work and the tone and the pacing. And I think that's what you have to do. And again, that's kind of what Be the Gateway really talks about. It's this whole idea of, instead of looking at it as, I don't know, keywords or metadata. I mean, some of that is very specific. There are, you know, the categories Amazon gives you are very specific. You should know them, but that's not really that hard. It really is the idea of figuring out that one reader at first and that one comp author and then getting to five comp authors. So who are the other authors that exist in the marketplace kind of sort of as you would? Where do they show up? How do they describe their books? Is it suspense thriller or psychological thriller? Or is it mystery thriller? What are those kind of phrases they use? What are the phrases that the marketplace, what will Amazon categorize them as? If I went down to my local indie bookstore, what would I say to get to their book? How do they shelve that book? How do they hand sell that book? What phrases do they use? In the same way you look at readers. And, you know, one thing I talk about, I think I talked about this in a blog post on your site as well, is the idea of really mining the data that Amazon gives you and Goodreads gives you in the reviews. You have, if you can find five comparable authors who are current authors, who are doing kind of okay, they're mid-list authors, not only can you read the voice of the reader, the actual reviews, you've got this amazing little search box. So you can start looking and saying, oh yeah, I keep seeing someone say, kept me guessing until the end. Let me go in that search box and put in the word guessing. And now you'll see 76 out of 400 reviews use the word guess. And you think, okay, so something about they want to be surprised. You know, I'll look up the word surprise. I'll look up the word thrilled. I'll look up And you start understanding the words that readers are using to describe your book instead of the opposite, which is, I think, what scares a lot of authors, which is saying, do keywords. And you're like, okay, let me do keywords. And you try to think it's coming from in here. You start there, but you've got to go out, analyze the marketplace, talk to readers. You can talk to them by going to Thriller Fest and all these amazing conferences. But even if you don't have that kind of time or that kind of money, just going on Amazon and just going on YouTube and just going on Goodreads, you start hearing people talk about this. I'm a total addict of YouTube in general. There's all these author talks on there, and you can see, well, how does an author talk at a book signing? What kinds of questions does Stephen King get? This stuff is publicly available as long as you have a web connection. And I feel like that's the kind of initial research you do to start really thinking about who is the audience, and more importantly, like, why do they resonate with these books, and how do they talk about the books? What's the language?
Yeah, and it's so funny because I wonder if the other thing that's possibly changed since 2013, and maybe it's just me realizing this, I used to think that everyone could be a successful indie author. But what you're talking about there is something, and running a business and all the things that we have to do now, the personality, like, some people will be listening and kind of cringing and going, well, I don't want to do that, you know? So what do you say to people who are like, well, I don't want to do that? Is it literally, well, then you have to get back in the queue for traditional publishing? Or like, how do you get people through that personality gap?
Because I don't think it's any easier for traditionally published authors. I mean, talk about that if you want as well. I mean, this is a big part of it. I think a lot of it is breaking it down to very simple steps where it suddenly becomes reasonable. Like again, for that video last week of the literacy that I did for my mastermind group, the assignment last week for them was, you have to describe what your creative work is, and you have to describe that to one person. So that meant at a barbecue, it meant online at Starbucks, it meant a friend you haven't talked to in a while. And it was literally that simple thing, because so many authors, I mean, I've been to a lot of conferences, as you have, and you're like, oh, you know, so are you a writer? And you've heard this a million times. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to write my first book, but I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a mystery, but really I'm an accountant and I don't know what I'm doing here. And they don't even know how to say, yes, I write novels like this and that. It's about X, Y, and Z. Do you write too? Like, they don't even know how to have that identity. And I find when you start at these little points, it's funny. One of the simplest things I've found with a lot of people is just having that confidence of, you know, I'm a writer and I'm doing this and I'm a professional. That is a really difficult milestone for a lot of people. So having that sense of being able to talk about what you do, and when someone says, what kind of books do you write? Of being able to say, well, you know, you ever read this book or seen that movie? And they say, yeah, you're like, it's kind of like that. And I add this in. Knowing how to kind of frame it in someone's head who has no idea, like just saying like, oh, I write literary fiction. What does that mean? Nobody knows what that means. It could mean anything. So it's part of that. I think it really is starting at that level of, how would you talk to someone else? How would you frame it for them? How would you get them interested? And I think a lot of times it's the idea of not pitching them. It's understanding, like, you know, I would never say like, I love horror movies, but that old movie with Brad Pitt, like Seven.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
That was like a horror movie, and it was great because it had these crazy twists to it, the actors, the whole thing. I give this example in the book, but like, I don't really like fantasy books. I don't really like the whole magic and wizard thing, but I love Harry Potter. I'm reading Harry Potter to my six-year-old right now. Again, because Harry Potter to me is not about wizards. It's about friendship and loyalty and how you use power and choices you make in life and all of that. So for people who are overwhelmed and saying, I don't want to do that, what I think of is this. You're writing for a reason. There's something you want to do, and part of it's entertainment, but part of it's something deeper. And when you talk about this, I'm not asking that you become a marketer and become savvy. It really is a matter of, you go down to your local cafe and someone comes, even better than that, you get in an elevator with Oprah Winfrey and she says, you know, wow, what do you do? How do you answer that question? Because that's what I'm asking for you to do, is just to talk to real people passionately about what you do. If you can do that, you can take out an ad because you have a sense of what to write. And the really savvy marketers I look at, and you're friends with a lot of these people, their email newsletters are not pitch, pitch, pitch. their stories. There's photos of them. There's hello from Salisbury.
we say Salisbury.
Salisbury. Sorry, I'm from New Jersey, America. It's this whole idea of they're not just pitching you in this salesy way. They're real people who understand that they want to know you and they want to know what you're about. And that's what I see with a lot of marketers. And I think that is a very human, more down-to-earth way of looking at it, is just knowing how to talk to someone who would love your book.
Mm. And I think, yeah, that's what we have to get back to, because it's too easy now to get into, and I mean, I interview lots of people on the show about data and ads. And of course, Mark Dawson's in Salisbury, which is why you mentioned it. And you can be the hardcore data person. And I love hearing from people who are hardcore data people, but I'm not that person. And what you've talked about there is very much more the human aspect. It was interesting, there's a blog post yesterday on Seth Godin's blog about this, about the human aspect, that marketing is kind of diverging into the human aspect versus the data aspect and machine learning and all this type of thing. Really interesting. Now, you and I have always done content marketing and, you know, doing things like this to attract people for free and then they might buy our book, whatever. But you also have in the book creating experiences, not content. So that seems to take it further. So what do you mean by that?
That's a big part of it. And I think that we get scared of marketing because we think that we have a product. These are the ear pod things. We've got to get to a sale. And I don't think that's what drives a lot of creative professionals, a lot of writers. I think that they really are considering, like in the book, I talk about, what is a book? The book is an experience. Like, you write it and you think that people are going to read it as you wrote it. They're not. That's the palette. Those are the colors. It's the canvas. And it's halfway there, but I read your book with my experiences. When I read Harry Potter and I get emotional because I'm bringing something from my past to that character. Mm. When he overcomes something, yes, I'm reading about a fake wizard using a Patronus to whatever that stuff is. But for me, it's that translation of that means a lot to me because once in seventh grade, and your story for that is different. So even that aspect of how someone reads a book is an experience that you've created for them. You want them to cry. You want them to laugh. You want them to feel a sense of escape. And I think that when you talk about the idea of platform or marketing or anything else, it's that as well. If you want to do an email newsletter, great. There's a lot out there. How are you creating experience? And I get this a lot. I've done a newsletter for 12 years, every single Friday. And I get feedback from people where they're just saying, it's like, it's not a Friday unless I get your email. You know, I wait for that. And for me, it's that sense too of like someone is waking up a very full inbox. You know, how do I draw them in a way that doesn't feel salesy, doesn't feel like I'm getting in the way, where they can read what they want and they can kind of move on? What is that experience? When you do a talk at a conference, when you do a podcast, you're crafting that experience as well. And you do this masterful job where it feels meaningful, but you're also so helpful to people. That's part of the experience. Mm. And I think that when we look at this, that's why whenever you go to an author reading and it's horrible, it's because that person had a sense of, this is like a resume. You do this, you do this, you do that. Mm. And the people who are great, you're like, why was that great? And you can say, oh, they're charismatic. It's like, no, they've done enough to get over that initial fear, certainly. But they saw the room. They said, you know, I mean, I see this all the time where they right away, I don't know why I think about this. Whenever you go to a wedding or a funeral, and the person who's officiating knows how to just break the tension in the room, it's because they know there's tension in the room. And even though we feel like there's a hierarchy here, we're not. We're just 80 people in a room together. And I'm going to recognize that. And they make a joke and they say, oh, I was talking to the groom before the wedding. I was talking to the mother before this. And they just break the tension. They create an experience instead of just going through a checkbox of, this is what the program says I have to do. And that's what people remember. And I think that's how people connect with other people.
And actually, I think the difference there, like you said, the author reading, I never agree to do author readings because I'm like, they don't want to hear me read from my book. It's meant to go in their head via the book. What they want is something that either helps them or entertains them or something. And it's not like, unless you do fiction, unless you do poetry, which is designed to be performed at a small length, like reading a paragraph from my novel is not going to help you get a sense of it. Like, it's better for me to spend that time maybe answering questions questions on how to write fiction or whatever else people want to talk about, as opposed to reading from my book. So that's why I never agree to do readings, but I do more events. But I did want to also come back on your regular, like you said, you've done a newsletter for 12 years. That's crazy. I mean, that's completely mad. But the regularity, this podcast, when I went from random every couple of weeks to every Monday morning, the audience just went up hugely. And I started Patreon. And thank you to everyone who supports the show on Patreon. I couldn't have done that without regular updates, whereas I'm terrible at newsletters, so I just don't do that. So do you think that's one of the keys? Like whatever you do, whatever practical thing you pick, you do it on a schedule?
I think so. And it's not that you can't experiment with it with the podcast and then say it wasn't for me, but it's the idea that you're crafting a relationship of some sort. And for people to expect that you're going to show up for them, to find value in that, people don't want to be abandoned. And I do think that I always think of something like that with how I grew up, where I grew up watching Johnny Carson 11:30 every night on NBC. And this is like in the 80s, my little black and white TV set. And it's a very weird thing because he felt like a part of the family. He was the voice I went to bed hearing. And there's some things, you know, you almost think of this is what celebrity is. This is why podcasts are so popular now. It's like a voice in your head. And to hear that voice every week, and that voice is personal, and we've amped up the bass a little bit so it sounds like really good. It is that sense where they feel a connection to you, and you're one of the characters in their life. And I think that we see that so much with people who have any kind of brand online. I mean, someone like Seth Godin, or you. You know, it's the idea that we feel connected to you, and the fact that you show up regularly really means something. I also think that for a lot of authors, they have that book launch, like a 2 or 3 year gap, and then nothing than book launch. And that does two negative things. One is that you feel like you're terrified of marketing again because you avoid it. So you have no dialogue with the audience. The other thing is you're not learning about your audience. You're not building a relationship one by one. Like one of the great things about podcasts for anyone, especially an interview-based podcast, you are making a connection to someone new every single week. So when your next book comes out and you email people, you have all these new colleagues, all these new fans, all these people you felt that you've done a favor for them because you have. And it's like, wow, over week by week, that really builds up. And the same with anything, whether it's Twitter or Instagram or a newsletter. Yeah, you might not get 1,000 new subscribers this month, but you might get one a day. And over the course of 3 years, that really adds up. And in that time, your writing has gotten better and the way you talk to your readership has gotten better.
Yeah. And actually, I was going to come back on the podcasting because, of course, we were talking more about datary things, but podcasting is really about relationships. Like this podcast is not open to pitches, but it's booked up for the next 6 months. And part of that is it's based on relationships that I make in some other way. Or like I interviewed a lady yesterday about bookbinding. I can't remember if she's before you or after you, Lisa, but you know, I found her on Instagram, and I was like, oh, wow, you're amazing. I want to talk to you. And I just emailed her and said, hey, I can't even remember how. Or she might be a listener to the podcast. Hello, Lisa. But anyway, the point is that I was coming back to is podcasting. And I've seen you've done a few podcasts for this book launch. Do you think that for nonfiction books, podcasting is the most powerful book sales technique or book marketing technique? Or what would you put it up then these days?
Well, I would say I would put it very highly because it has all of the foundational tenets of what you should do for any good business, which is, I did a blog post about this guy's book, and he had a podcast, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, because podcasting emulates what you want, which is consistent output, consistent focus, and more importantly, relationship building, consistent, steady, meaningful relationship building. If you're doing a podcast over the course of months or years, that's what it does. It forces you to build the business practice of publishing, of getting clear on your message, of outreach, of marketing. It's like a habit. It's like the perfect sense of what a practice is. It is great. The problem with it is that you can't just do a podcast right around launch and expect it to get you anywhere. when you've done it as long as you have with so consistently, well, that is enormously powerful. And the reason I brought up, I forget the name of the book, is Michael something or other, it was recently on my blog, where, you know, he's like, well, how did I get Brené Brown to blurb my book? I interviewed her 5 years ago. I'm just like, man, like the power of, not just the power of podcasts, the power of being early to podcasts and not stopping. Yeah, that not stopping is so much in life.
Yeah, I guess I mean the other way, because I'm not suggesting that people start a podcast. I think it's okay. a big amount of work. What I'm saying is, as a author with a new book, is pitching podcasts part of your marketing plan in general? And why is that? And is that what people should do, basically?
Definitely. Yes, definitely. And I would say it used to be, you know, a blog tour. The problem with that is that too much of them are just like turnkey. You're often kind of sitting around the same press release, but a podcast is a real conversation. It also embodies the fact that you have to hold the conversation. The podcaster probably doesn't want to just talk about your book. We've talked about so many things that are around the sphere of my book, but we haven't just sat here saying, Dan, what's the book about? What's the first chapter? You know, like, not at all. We might not even get there, and that's fine, because it's all in that sense of you have to be able to talk to that audience. And more importantly, you just said this, the podcaster and the interviewee have to have some kind of dialogue. So I do think it's important because, one, they're very popular. Two, if someone starts listening, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, you're in their ear. Mm-hmm. And then three, you kind of get a lot of opportunities to wow someone. You might not be a great speaker. Your book might be okay, but if you're also a gardener and the listener's a gardener and the podcaster interviewee is a gardener, like, that funny little quirk will actually become a big part of how people find you charming and pick up your book.
Yeah. And you should always try and throw in those personal details. You know, like you mentioning reading a book to your son is a very visual image that people can imagine and, you know, go, oh, right, he's just a guy like me, you know, with a 6-year-old and a new baby and whatever. So I guess thinking about podcasting and tech and the way things are going, you're wearing the swanky new earbuds with no wire. I have a wire. You're quite a tech guy, like you like tech, don't you? You're an Apple guy. How do you think that the tech stuff is shaping the way books are consumed and marketed? So nonfiction in particular, for example, I'm finding audiobook sales for nonfiction vastly better than fiction. You know, the consumption of the podcast, like I don't really even read blogs anymore. I don't like subscribing to newsletters. I'd rather listen on a show. How do you think that's changing? And is that changing the way that people can reach people through the gateway?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, a big word that I really focus on is empathy. So when you think about the nonfiction book reader and you think of, you know, whether it's a podcast or an audiobook, if you're tapping into that same thing, which is they're busy people who want to expand themselves professionally, they're interested in the idea, they don't have any time, but they're sitting on that train or in the car or on the bus or they're jogging or cycling. And when you have empathy with that person, you start thinking that it's not that you've got to be techie, although it is technical to do any of these things. You're really thinking, when do people have time? This person has 3 kids, they work, their spouse works. Like, when do they have time? And it's like, oh, audio. You know, I keep talking to my audience and I keep finding these busy professionals. I wrote a book about leadership. You know, genius idea. They don't have time to always read. So they're doing other things. So I think that it's not necessarily starting with tech. It's starting with empathy. But I do think that, as I said before, technology has given us a lot more opportunity. And this is where, again, maybe it's for nonfiction, we can talk about fiction, where this is where you have a lot of things where, you know, download my book now and you'll get free, you know, a 20-part video course and free 20 guidebooks and worksheets and that kind of thing, where you think about the value add, you think about the goal of someone reading that. And it's different for fiction or for memoir or for nonfiction.
Yeah, it is interesting. I do want to focus on nonfiction because that's what you write. I know you have clients who write fiction, but we talk a lot about fiction on this show, so I like doing nonfiction as well. And I guess I've also literally, before we got on the phone, I'm just doing my annual, it's my company year end, so I'm doing my annual look at my book sales and everything. And nonfiction is really interesting because I sell a lot more nonfiction books in print as well as in audio, whereas my fiction sales are primarily ebook. So how have you, like, as a nonfiction author, how have you found the sales for print versus ebook versus audio, and you know, are there things that nonfiction authors should focus on? For example, doing a hardback with Ingram Spark in order to look similar to some other nonfiction authors.
Yeah, I mean, for myself personally, it'd be the gateway. Again, there was a compressed time frame, but I found that. So I found like twice as many print book sales. I had like a I'll call it a launch team, but this kind of a team of people were helping advise me. These are like fans of mine from the newsletter. And I brought them in so they could kind of help me figure out decision-making. And that's the feedback that they gave me. They said, raise the price. They forced me to raise the price of the book. They said, it's like, yeah, you know, I read a lot of fiction on my Kindle or whatever, but like nonfiction, I like to have it. And they explained why. I like to mark it up. I like to put on my shelf. I want as a reference. And these are assumptions I could have made, but I didn't really know. And I think that's part of the opportunity. You're mentioning audio. Because of my time frame, I had no chance for that, no time to do that. And now as you're saying in my head, I'm literally have a post-it note right here in my brain, like, do audiobook. Like, because I've read that, but then you forget, you get busy, and it's like, of course. Mm. So I think that I'm trying to remember the question. The difference with nonfiction is, yeah, you have to think about that difference. And I think there is a huge difference with that. Absolutely.
Mm. No, absolutely. We could talk for ages, but we're actually almost running out of time. And I did want to talk, ask you about, because you're in New York and I see you whenever I come to New York and we hang out, which is great, and have coffee and stuff. Now, because you're in New York, you're also in with a lot of people in traditional publishing. You've been around publishing for so long and you do consulting and speaking. And I wondered what your thoughts are, because at the moment, one of the things that's happening, I mean, Amazon's been dominant for years, but since 2013, we've seen some of the big things, physical bookstores, we've seen Amazon Publishing become increasingly dominant in the book charts on Amazon, plus things like in the last couple of weeks, moving into the Middle East, Australia. On the one hand, it's like, yay, because as authors, we love Amazon and we're tied into Amazon. And on the other hand, it's like, oh my goodness. So what are your feelings, or like, what is the feeling in New York around this kind of shift? Have you been to those bookstores as well?
Not the Amazon one. I can only speak for myself. Mm. I mean, I do have a lot of friends in publishing. I think one thing that Amazon does well is they think about the reader, and they've been very innovative because they haven't had any industry thing holding them back. They said, if it, you know, whatever that is, we'll do that. And because that gets a book to a person faster, gets a recommended book faster. I also see the opposite, not the opposite, but I see that reflected locally. 3 years ago, a local friend opened a brand new indie bookstore here. A year and a half ago, she moved to a bigger bookstore, one of those prominent buildings in town. She has this way too big bookstore now. Like, I mean, it was like a big jump. Another friend moved to town. She spent 20 years in major publishing, like vice president of marketing and major publishers. She just left her job to become the manager for this bookstore. Mm. And what I see with Barb and Rachel is that they are a part of the community. And the same thing in a different way that Amazon is doing, that sense of where are readers? What do readers want? How do we actually get more books to people? How do we make it easier? How do we make, whether that's cheaper or shipping or whatever it is? I see that's what they're doing. They're saying, we're going to invest in a bookstore in town. We're going to get all the local organizations involved. We're going to get Rachel in here and find a way to get her to work for the store. Rachel's already doing all these crazy events and getting all these people involved and bringing that truly A-level marketing brain into running a small bookstore in a small town. I think there's a lot of innovation around just the reader, and that's how I view it. And I think Amazon is complex in that way, philosophically. When I see something like that video of Amazon's food store idea, that concerns me because I go to my food store a lot and I see all the employees there And I see that these are real people, and a lot of them are not 16 years old. They're 45, 55, 65. And I look at the supply chain and I think, I like these people in my town. I see them every day. I don't want them to lose their job. There's a complexity with Amazon. But in the end, with a lot of it, it's great I can see reviews. It's great I get really, truly catered stuff to me. So it's a weird philosophical dilemma, but I do think they're thinking about what truly gets people to buy and read books. And they're very aggressive about that. And it's a very similar thing as I see locally with an indie bookseller, which is on the opposite side of the Amazon chain, where they want you to buy locally.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I do think what you're saying is true, that there's an increasing amount. It's interesting you said about grocery shopping. I don't grocery shop. I order on my phone. So we get groceries delivered, and we didn't have a car for like 6 years. So part of it was, it's easier to get stuff delivered. And so I've been doing that for years. And now I'm feeling guilty because the robots run the warehouse, but there are drivers. It is interesting how that technology shift, I think we're going, there's obviously people moving further to buying online, but there's also, when I have a break, like yesterday I went round to the local independent bookstore and I bought like 3 hardback books to, that I'm, for some other project. And so it's doing both, and there is the increase in both, like we're seeing in publishing, the problem is in the middle. Like if you're trying to do everything. So I see the rise of digital and the rise of beautiful print, but the missing is probably the mass market paperback. Is that, do you think ebooks will, like if we're going to talk again in like 2020, is the mass market paperback dead? And are we now ebooks, audiobooks, and beautiful print?
I don't know the trends enough to really say, but I don't believe necessarily in that thing where beautiful books, I think that just books, just the boring format. I was at the bookstore yesterday when it was a pretty recent book and the paper stock was horrible. And it was a big book and I didn't care. It's like, I don't think it has to be beautiful. I know Seth Godin talks about this, the beautiful crafted thing and all that stuff, but it's like the book format is just so perfect. Even a mass market paperback. So I don't know the trends enough to speak that way, but I don't believe it's either the beautiful object you want to put on your shelf or the easy cheap ebook. I think there's a big middle ground there.
Oh, good. I was about to ask that question. Okay, so I know we've talked about loads of things, but just tell us a bit more about Be the Gateway. I mean, we've talked peripherally about it, but tell people what they can find in that book.
Yeah, so this is sort of my view of how you can practically start thinking about who your audience is and reaching them. It's broken into 3 parts. It's the idea of looking at your creative work as a gateway, because that helps you think about why you create and how you would share and market that in the same pure place. The middle part is about opening that gate. It's about really audience research. I think this is the step a lot of authors don't do. How do you start understanding the marketplace and the ideal reader and people that reach those readers and doing it in a way that isn't slimy and uses all these great tools that are accessible? And the last part is walking someone through the gate. It's not how to launch a newsletter for 1 billion subscribers in one day. It's if you can walk one person through the gate to get them to understand what you do and why and get them to buy the book, boom, you've done what most authors can't. Now you can do it with 2 people. Now you can do 4 people and 8 people and 16 people. And every time you do that, you learn so much. I used to work in a big publisher, a magazine publisher. They do all these studies. We'd get like, we have 4 million data points, all of that kind of stuff. And that's great. That's fine. I've also known that if we want an opinion on something, if we ask 3 to 5 people, we're going to learn 70% of what we need to know just by talking to 3 to 5 people. And we'll get into details after that. And this is the idea of like, if you can't talk to one person and say, this is what you do, and this is what you write, this is why you write it, you can't sum up, are they the right person? If you can't ask them a question and figure out, how are you doing that with 100 people, 100,000 people? And that's kind of the structure of the book. And I try to get very practical about how to do each step and really breaking it down. And for me, you mentioned this earlier, it really is trying to bring it down to a human process, a process that is not scary and big, one where you feel like you're you know, where you're starting with nothing, you've got to expose yourself on the line to do that. That it really is about connecting with real people and about really staying true to why you're writing.
No, that's great. So tell people where they can find you and your book and everything you do online.
The book right now is at Amazon.com, Be the Gateway. Everything else I do is on WeGrowMedia.com. And I'm at Dan Blank on all the normal social media like Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. That's where you can find me. Yeah.
Super. Thanks so much for your time, Dan. That was great.
Thank you.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dan Blank, and you can check out his new book now, Be the Gateway, a practical guide to sharing your creative work and engaging an audience. And next week, I'm talking about how to write a mystery, a discussion between me and New York Times bestseller Rebecca Cantrell, who has also won a ton of awards for her writing. And Becky's fantastic. And we have a really great chat about writing mystery, and we have a super box set deal for you, which I will tell you about next time. So happy writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.